Spain, right? Like, why is that? Like why? Obviously, we have to have a bias because we have to be concerned with things that allow us to make a coherent story or tell a coherent story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to be able to tell a particular story, right? And what's significant about the sort of framework within which we see, the thing is, it's not just like a conscious framework within which we exist and try to organize things, right? These are the sort of, how do I want to put it? It's the frame within which we see things as being relevant or being valuable or being worth noting, right? So if we want to tell a particular history, as soon as we start doing that history, we're already engaged in selection and whatnot. And that's, again, the point is to say that that's not bad. It's the condition for doing it, right? Now, the question, or the one of the other important things that Carr wants to say, though, is that not only is the framework that we use to make salient certain facts into historical facts, not only is it present, but it itself is historically conditioned, right? Like, and so your histories are going to look differently depending on the point at which you're doing history, and the histories that matter at a, like, say, in the present, the histories of the past that matter to the present will themselves be selected for kind of differently based on whatever I'm trying to use like a neutral term for the framework that selects for salient historical facts. But the point that I'm saying is that not only are the facts filtered through this framework that gives them their historical value, but the framework itself emerges over time. And it's at this point, Carr says that it's conscious of itself, and that the conscious framework that we're aware of now is progress. He calls himself kind of old-fashioned in saying that, yeah, like, I view history through progress, okay? Maybe there are different historiographers who use a different thing, but I see things in terms of progress. And then in the last chapter, he actually gives a profession of faith to the future, where he says that we have to keep viewing things in terms of progress because that's how we, that's just how we progress. But in any case,
but you know, yeah. I was going to say, but it's exactly like that. I'm glad the topic of progress came up, because that's often a sort of ideological outlook or historical outlook, or ideology of history, you might call it, that is very common. Like, that's probably one of the most common motifs, but at the same, it's also used in a kind, like, you know, it's so common that in itself has been used in historical ways to draw lines. So the obvious example I'm thinking about would be like Francis Fukuyama talking about the end of the Soviet Union. You see the end of history, which is incidentally, in a sense, also written out as the end of progress, right? Like, history has been this movement from one stage to another, two steps forward, one steps back, but, you know, this kind of stage, this momentum moving forward. And yet, you know, this whole progression narrative can also be used in such a way where it's written out to be, you know, to come to some sort of completion, right? Like, you know, it's the liberal democratic completion, you know, moment. Obviously, that's not really how things have, like, turned out, you know, kind of unsurprisingly to the whole gist of the theme and topic today. But you can even see how within that, like, even those sorts of motifs of concepts can sort of be used also as historical markers.
So at the point that we're at, E.H. Carr has essentially, he said several things, but the framework that I'm sort of getting out of what E.H. Carr is saying is that historical facts gain their historical value through these frameworks. One of the frameworks that we use is progress. He himself uses that, and he recognizes that it is a historical, product. It's a historical framework. It can be superseded. It didn't always exist, but it organizes facts into having a certain value for a certain end. And that's another important point, is that historians are not just using this, or they're not just using their value frameworks in order to tell interesting stories, though that is one of the sort of fruits of history, is that you have a valuable work of you have a valuable story. He actually Carr actually explicitly calls literature meaningless, whereas history actually has a meaning because it has some kind of objective value, because it has a standard. The standard changes, but it has a standard because you can organize these things, right? Historians do also have roles to play. Historians are not just they're not just applying values in order to tell, you know, a compelling story. They actually do shape their culture. They do shape their environment. They play an active role in maybe changing it, maybe maintaining it, maybe challenging it, maybe subverting it, maybe even you know, in any case, they have some kind of role to play in the generation and the overall life of the culture. So, and the role that you, or the role that they play, is, again, it references that standard by which things gain their historical value. And again, for E.H. Carr, since that historical standard is progress, or the historical facts that are relevant in any given period, at least for E.H. Carr, are facts of progress contributing to progress, right? He has this analogy about, and this is in a chapter on causation in history, so it goes back to this idea of Cleopatra's nose, right? The reason Cleopatra's nose is kind of irrelevant is because it's not like a salient part of seeing the overall picture, right? He has a story about, I'll just find it. He has a story about, by way of analogy, he says, okay, imagine a car accident, right? Someone gets hit by a car, and there's all of these various factors. So here's a quick picture. And the reason I'm referring to the text here is because the factors actually matter. Like, this is the point that Carr is making, is that some factors matter and some factors don't, right? So Jones, returning from a party at which he has consumed more than his usual ration of alcohol, in a car whose brakes turn out to have been defective, at a blind corner where visibility is notoriously poor, knocks down and kills Robinson, who is crossing the road to buy cigarettes at the shop on the corner. After the mess has been cleared up, we meet, say, at local police headquarters to inquire into the causes of the occurrence. Was it due to the driver's semi-intoxicated condition, in which case there might be criminal prosecution? Or was it due to the defective brakes, in which case something might be said to the garage which overhauled the car only the week before? Or was it due to the blind corner, in which case the road authorities might be invited to give the matter their attention? While we are discussing these practical questions, two distinguished gentlemen, I shall not attempt to identify them. He is taking jabs at Karl Popper and Sir Isaiah Berlin. I shall not attempt to identify them. Burst into the room and begin to tell us with great fluency and cogency that if Robinson had not happened to run out of cigarettes that evening, he would not have been crossing the road and would not have been killed, that Robinson's desire for cigarettes was therefore the cause of his death, and that any inquiry which neglects this cause will be wasted time and any conclusions drawn from it meaningless and futile. Well, what do we do? As soon as we break into the flow of eloquence, we edge our two visitors gently but firmly towards the door. We instruct the janitor on no account to admit them, and we get on with our inquiry. But what answer have we to the interrupters? Of course Robinson was killed because he was a cigarette smoker. Everything that the devotees of chance and contingency in history say is perfectly true and perfectly logical. It has the kind of remorseless logic which we find in Alice in Wonderland. But while I yield to none of my admiration for these ripe examples of Oxford scholarship. I prefer to keep my different modes of logic in separate compartments. In any case, the point of the illustration is that, say someone gets hit in a car accident, the purpose of them crossing the road in which they were hit is not really relevant when there are all these other more important factors, right? And the reason that Robinson being a smoker is not a relevant factor is because when we are engaged in the inquiry of determining the causes of Robinson's death, it's in order to mitigate further deaths, right? You can't, like, the reason or the cause of him being a smoker is not a reason that we can use to mitigate car accident deaths, right? Like, you aren't, like, the reason you would ban smoking or educate people not to smoke is not in order to prevent car accidents. What you would do is you investigate that particular instance, and then certain variables show themselves as relevant to preventing further deaths, right? And I think that this example for E.H. Carr is not just illustrative, because it shows one case, or like a really good case of certain variables being relevant and some not. It actually does kind of tie back to Carr's conscious Victorianism and belief in progress, and it's because he thinks that history is a matter of progress and humanism and trying to gain mastery. He explicitly says that, just like all kinds of art and all kinds of science, history contributes to the sciences insofar as history makes a contribution to our mastery over our environment, right? What history should do is help us to see the blind corner in the past. It should help us to see the intoxicated driver at our governments and whatnot. It should help us to actually make a difference in our own lives, in our own history, in our present. And you can then go on to make a better, like, you can then judge that those actions based on the, in the future, historians will then judge the actions of the present based on some standard. Perhaps that standard will change. We can't control that. But right now, what we have is a standard to judge our actions and to try and make something kind of better of that. Now, again, Carr is enormously conscious of the fact that this particular framework is contingent. It is historically rooted. It might be different in the future. There might be better standards for judging, but this is the, these are the resources that he has as a historian to judge and select for salient facts in the analysis of the past. Is, does it contribute to our mastery over our environment? Does it contribute to progress, essentially?
One, obviously, he's going through the lens of progress, but I think he's also highlighting, I think within the process of doing that, you kind of ask yourself, okay, well, what is, like, looking at any particular historical scenario, like, what do we consider the ordinary and what do we consider the extraordinary in the story that we're trying to, you know, understand? And, you know, and by virtue of that, like, what things stand out. And at the same time as well, we're kind of doing this process of seeing history. You know, this is obvious, but it kind of gets lost, I think, sometimes, which is that, you know, history is not the past, right? Like, and you know, I think a lot of times people can kind of confuse that when you talk about history. It's like everything that, you know, happened before us, or you might be able to, the ancient things, or the big World War II is history or whatever. It's like World War II was an event. And we do history about World War II, and we do history about World War II in many ways, but each one of those ways has its own particular style or interest or focus. You know, I think about, you had mentioned Abe Lincoln, and as you were discussing the, early in the episode, you mentioned Abe Lincoln, and as you were discussing the topic of the, of being hit by the car and what's salient within that context, I thought about, you know, Abraham Lincoln, I thought about his assassination. You know, when we think about, and why it's relevant for us, when we think about heads of state, when we think about, you know, heads of state when we think about things like security, when we think about even trying to understand historical contingency, when we try and think about, you know, what might be called social tragedies or social mourning or whatever that might be, or societal mourning or veneration. You know, we think about the assassination of Abe Lincoln and we don't go, you know, the reason for all of that or why that happened is because Abraham Lincoln went to the theater, right? He did go to the theater. Like, that's true, right? Like, he did go to the theater. And, you know, and John Wilkes Booth found him at the theater. And if he hadn't been at the theater that day, he might not have been assassinated and things might have been different. But his assassination is him being at the theater rather is more or less just a sort of stylistic fact, a little bit of flourish for the fact that he, you know, he was at the theater while he was assassinated. But the important point is that he was assassinated by such and such a person who had such and such a beat, and he was killed at such and such time. You know, it had this sort of impact and shift or whatever it might be and has continued to radiate out that way, right? And him, you know, again, going to a show is not the most important thing. But I also find it interesting how aware he is that the lens of progress is itself a lens. And I think that this goes back to what we were talking about kind of at the beginning, which is, you know, Carr's vision of the of history as a practice is one that is always has to be somewhat self-undermining because history itself is always a part of history and always has historical context. And so, you know, like humans have been doing history for a very long time, as long, at least as long basically as, you know, the written word and forms of recording or even symbolic, you know, even perhaps before the written word, but, you know, symbolic systems, whatever it might be. What history has and was might be very different. So, for example, one thing might think about something like Old and Middle Kingdom and things like that, very, very ancient societies that had relatively static sort of cultural, hierarchical, and symbolic systems, and that and history was very active, but it was generally a way of cementing the legitimacy of the system itself, right? Like history was not an investigative process so much as it was a narrative for, you know, here are the events that happened, here that happened, for why, you know, why the Egyptian society and culture and religion is the way it is, right? And continues to function that way and should stay that way, right? Has that sort of an ethical impetus to it as well. And that's just an example of that sort of hierarchical and social and cultural religious justification is another way in which history, you know, can be used and is often done in opposition to like progress, and therefore showing Carr's point that like progress is not necessarily the lens that you have to do this by, right?
No, yeah.
It doesn't have to be the way we see things.
No, yeah, that's actually an interesting point. So there's something, there's kind of an offhand comment, and it was something that I was thinking about just in the back of my mind of like, well, what do I want to make of this? Because it touches on themes that feel really important to me, but I don't know how to like apply them or make them more important than they seem to me. And it's this idea that there's two ways of understanding time. There's a linear, so there's like a rectilinear way of seeing time where the past travels into the present and then the present travels into the future. And then there's a cyclical conception of time where events occur over and over and they're modeled on the life cycle, on the seasons, right? They're more rooted in the life processes, but they don't have the sort of end point or the direction that time has, or that rectilinear time has. Carr makes this point that history really begins when events in the past explain events in the present that are trying to explain what will happen in the future. And that's not a that's not an account that is compatible with a cyclical conception of time, because in a cyclical conception of time, you don't need to explain what is, you don't need to try to figure out what is going to happen in the future. Like, guess what's going to happen in the fall? The leaves are going to fall. If you're, you know, in Egypt, guess what's going to happen to the Nile? It's going to flood. You don't need to predict those sorts of things. Now, this goes back to the point that you're making, because if you're an Egyptian, you do live in a cyclical time conception where the Nile floods, where the new pharaoh is enthroned. History can prop up, it can explain, it can justify this cyclical conception. It can tell you why the cyclical conception is the way it is. It doesn't make any predictions, but it's kind of propaganda in that way, right? But what we think of as history, and I think this is why Carr thinks that something about progress is really important, or at least or is even maybe essential to history per se, is that for Carr, history really begins when you stop using history just to prop up things that happened, and you're actually trying to do something with history. You're trying to do something with the story that you say. The salient facts that you pick out are not just to explain or to rationalize or to, propagandize the way that things seem to be or the way that they are. It's actually an attempt by free people to try and determine themselves beyond just that cyclical conception, beyond just what has to happen. The past can help us determine what to do in the future. And I think that is characteristic of the rectilinear conception of time that Carr thinks history is more appropriate for, and is one of the reasons why he thinks that progress is one of the better standards for trying to do history in this way.
I think that that is a defining point for doing a kind of, you know, history for its own sake, one might say. But I also think, you're going back to kind of the roots of like what Carr is pointing out, it sort of points out that in birthing that kind of independence, it also reveals the sorts of struggles and anxieties that modern historians have, right? Because like if you're in the cyclical conception, again, you're in ancient Egypt, whatever, the fact that it's justifying a system that you are embedded in itself allows any sort of historical practice itself to sort of be kind of protected by that system, right? Like, you know, the history goes back of, you know, of the gods who have been around forever, and they've done these sorts of things, they've given these certain laws, and because they've given these sorts of laws at the same sort, it's not maybe the best argument, but it is functionally, I think, the way it works more or less, because, you know, these are sort of ordained, these stories are true and have their legitimacy, and like, you know, and we understand why and what is important. When history becomes its own discipline, yeah, you start to move history into something that's being done for its own sake, for its own interest, for its own study, or whatever it might be. But at the same time, you then, as we were talking about earlier, go on the hunt for historical facts. And every historical fact is going to be value-laden, and the process that you have for picking those historical facts is also going to be value-laden. And so then you're left in that kind of catch-22 position of wanting to, as we talked about earlier, have this more objective perspective while dealing with deeply subjective content within that whole process.
And this goes back to kind of, you were saying, the anxiety of the historian in a certain way. So imagine a cyclical consciousness sort of emerging into this rectilinear consciousness, one that gets to start determining its own story or deciding what it wants to do with its past, right? There is a certain kind of freedom in that, but that freedom is always accompanied by an anxiety, you know, by what right or by what standard. And again, I don't, like, this is what's interesting about Carr, is he's so conscious of the fact that he has this standard, and it's not an eternal standard. And in a certain way, the people who want to go beyond into like a universal abstract standard, I think we've used the term copes before, you know, that's sort of like a cope. You are trying to reach for something that's not actually there. You're trying to exit the dialogue of events interacting with the historian, the person who's trying to tell that story, you're trying to sort of impose something in a one-way relation, but that doesn't really exist in the kind of consciousness conception that the rectilinear historian has to engage with. The condition for doing what you're doing is a dialogue between the future and the past, because there is like an almost existential note to hit there. But for some, I'm trying to also resonate that, like, somehow that anxiety just doesn't exist for Carr. He's firmly committed to and believes in something like progress, but it doesn't come off as like a cope to me, you know, because he understands that standard, in order to be a standard, has to be up in the air. It has to be contingent. He just understands the conditions under which he lives.
I think that's, you know, we've used the term sincerity before in the show, and I think, you know, sincerely being a historian involves, you know, on the one hand, taking your discipline seriously, while at the same time being cognizant of whatever those limitations might actually be. Sometimes there's this like nihilistic trap in any sort of, especially humanities-based discipline, where it's like, well, you know, none of this can ever be like really truly confirmed, like, you know, like a maths or whatever, right? But I think, you know, Carr is someone who probably fully understands that that's not the point. You know, that you're like, if that's what you're aiming for, if you're a historian aiming for that kind of thing, then you will be, you know, ripped apart by some sort of internal anxiety or have to commit to some sort of delusion. And I think that we see that, and we've seen that many times with historians who are more, you know, politically or religiously or aligned in some kind of particular way where, you know, they desperately need our collective story as it's best written to be a certain way. And so therefore their writing of our collective story of history is quite poor because it's not open to that kind of flexibility.
It's interesting, right? You can have like a sort of theological or ideological framework, and you can absolutely get all your historical ducks in a row. You can line up all the significant facts that contribute to and prop up this story. And yet somehow, maybe it's just because I don't have the ideology or something like that, they don't actually stand up to scrutiny. Those facts aren't actually salient in trying to explain why something might be historically significant. Again, maybe it's just because I'm not an ideologue, but this idea of a standard in history, what that might look like, why that's important, essentially because it's a condition for doing history. It's a much more mild way of putting something like an objective standard, quote unquote, into history, rather than, you know, an ideological or even metaphysical standard. Tying it to the condition for the possibility of historically salient facts, I think, was not just like an intellectually clever move, but it also goes to explaining my own interest in history as well, which is why I found it illuminating and an interesting read. It's quite a short work, so if you're interested in reading it as well, it can be read through quite quickly. And he's not an awful writer, though. Again, he is a self-professed Victorian, and I did quote him, so his style is a bit old-fashioned. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Thank you for listening. I've been your host, Brandon. Joining me has been Hale. Join us next week.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, Canada.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.